Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
Happy birthday, Dr. Redmond.
Well, thank you.
Specifically not saying it until we were on the show, so everyone could know we recorded this on your birthday, which is not at all relevant to when they're listening to it in, like, October. But I still think it's a nice thing to give you a shout-out for.
Well, thank you.
In any event, Well, it is your birthday, but that doesn't mean we don't have Criminal Minds to talk about. Specifically, the start of... Is it bad to call it the first terrible season of Criminal Minds? Or was 5 the first terrible season of Criminal Minds?
No, I don't think 5 was terrible. No. But you could see things were starting to fall
apart. The cracks were showing, yeah.
Yeah, in season 5. Season 6, and what I'm going to do, we don't normally ever do this, but... I just had to do this. I read it when I pulled up the Wikipedia page for Criminal Minds, where we take our synopses off of.
Yeah.
And so I'm reading this and the blurb for the entire season. Before filming the season began, it was announced that AJ Cook had been let go from the series, reportedly due to budget cuts on the show. relating to the launch of the Criminal Minds spinoff, that would be Suspect Behavior.
Yeah.
Thanks to letters and petitions by fans, Cook was allowed to return for 2 episodes to wrap up her character storyline. She later returned as a special guest star in 2 subsequent episodes of this season. Padgett Brewster was a regular for 18 episodes and was let go from the series as well. In fact, she was killed off.
Yeah.
They really didn't want her back, so she must have gotten into a real fight with Erica. But anyway, Rachel Nichols, or she turned down Les Moonves. Rachel Nichols appeared as a guest star for 2 episodes and was then promoted as a regular, but was fired after the season finale. So if you want to know why the season was so horrible,
it's the first season of the show. Where you're like, I feel like the behind-the-scenes drama this year is so much more interesting than the show this year.
There has got to be so much behind-the-scenes drama.
Yeah.
Because you just read this as the Wikipedia synopsis, and you're going, do you know what that's got to do to a show? We've seen other shows that just do that. It just... Yeah. And it should never... anyway... Never mind.
You know what? We're going to get there.
You're just looking at this, right?
And
just
totally.
What?
No, absolutely.
It had to be a complete mess.
All right. And speaking of, now, I was just saying that, the thing for me is I had no idea how bad it was going to get because, how could you? So just a little story from way further into the future of Criminal Minds. Then we'll get to this season. I was watching a season, reviewing. That's right. Reviews are coming, people. An episode from season 10. And I give the writers of this show a lot of crap for not knowing things.
Yeah.
But I saw something happen that was so dumb that it's like, this isn't, knowing about psychology. This isn't knowing something about, human nature. This isn't knowing about, basic story structure. This isn't even knowing about, like, police procedure. The episodes are so sloppily produced, right, that there's an episode, and I'm sure you remember this one, where a body is found in Lake Mead, which is the lake that is above the Hoover Dam, right? So it's right outside of Las Vegas, lake above the Hoover Dam. It's called Lake Mead. And so they find a body in the lake. And so they get into this discussion of, why can't we find this missing person? Why can't we find this missing person? Well, there's no one missing in the state of Nevada. And I'm like, first off, the combined states of Nevada and Arizona have a population of 10 million people. 40 million people visit Las Vegas every year, and that's like 50 miles from Lake Mead. So if you find, a serial killer's victim is most likely to be a transient person, a person who's not, like, rooted in the area in a stable way, right? And so if you find someone dead around Las Vegas, chances are it's not someone from Nevada or even Arizona, chances are it's a visitor. But beside that point, right? So you would do a nationwide search missing persons anyway. But they're like, what a brilliant forensic countermeasure. Dropping someone on the Nevada side of the border of Lake Mead. That way the cops will stop looking at the border and they'll never realize you killed someone from Arizona. Genius play on the killer's part, but we, the FBI, are the only people smart enough to figure it out. Right? And so I listen to that and I'm sickened and disgusted. Because everyone, like, of all the people working on the show, no one seems to understand that Lake Mead is a national park. It's not owned. Like, if you find a body in Lake Mead, you call the FBI. It is the worst possible forensic countermeasure to drop a body in a national park. It is the dumbest thing you could possibly do. But I honestly believe the writers have no idea that Lake Mead is a national park.
Why would they?
Why would they? It only took me 12 seconds to Google it. And to honestly, they're making a TV show. They can't be bothered to spend 12 seconds to fix a basic error in their script. Yeah. So yeah, I'm consistently shocked and horrified by how bad the writing gets. I mean, everyone keeps telling me that the show only gets worse and every season is worse than the season before it, but I am so agape at some of the things that have happened in season 10 that I could only imagine what seasons 11 and 12 are like. Like, it's going to get. If it's already this bad, I'm like, how bad can the show get?
Well, here's the funny thing, right? You always talk, we talk Criminal Minds, and everybody seems to go, like, even yesterday I saw my foot person, right? To get my nails and everything else, and have these issues.
Just keep going. Keep going.
Right? So we're talking about this. I was talking about The Inside and that sort of stuff. And she says, well, you know, she says, I stopped watching Criminal Minds because it got so bad. She said, it's just like every other thing on the... She said, it was really good in the beginning. She said, and then she just stopped. I said, season six is when, I think six and seven is when a lot of people stopped watching.
Yeah.
Even if they got through season six, we masochists continued. Does DM still watch it?
She does, amazingly. She, you know, clued me in about the dumbest, like, every now and then she will tell me about, the dumbest thing she's ever seen on television, and it's invariably an episode of Criminal Minds. I think she might have stopped after season 13, because there was one episode that was so just terrible. She just told me, I'm probably never going to watch this show again. But you know what? I can't wait to find out what that was when I get to season 13. Okay, so let's do this thing. Let's move on to season 6. And we open with, I mean, come on. Tim Curry's a national treasure. Really a global treasure. Like, the man's a genius.
Oh, yes.
All right, so let's get to it.
Number one. Okay, so it's called The Longest Night.
Right.
With Detective Spicer dead, Los Angeles still suffering from citywide blackouts, and the Prince of Darkness still at large, the BAU juggles tracking him down and rescuing. No, they don't juggle. It's the same thing.
No, tracking him down and rescuing her is the same thing.
It's
how
the same
thing.
How
is the synopsis is this bad?
I don't. Anyway, you know, we can't blame. It was written, and you just said it was. It's such a good episode.
No, it is. It really is.
And this episode was written by Edward Alan Bernero, and it was directed by Edward Alan Bernero, and you can tell.
So I will say one thing, though, and I mean, this is something that I didn't really think about the first time I watched it, or maybe I did, and it's in my review. I don't reread the reviews, so I would never know. But I've got to say, one thing that bothered me about the episode as I was rewatching it, and again, it's something you just give them. I mean, last time we gave them the entire premise of the episode makes no sense.
Yeah, okay.
Which is true. The entire premise of the episode makes zero sense. But it's a great episode of the show anyway, just, you know, mechanically speaking and as from an acting standpoint. So what I will say about this episode, though, is... I have a hard time believing, like, given the traffic situation we're told about in LA, I did spend a few moments looking and thinking, how is he able to get around so easily in that giant RV? Because he's able to get all across town during a blackout, during an epic traffic jam. Like, they're barely able to follow him places, and they have lights and sirens they can turn on to cut their way through traffic jams.
Oh, now, here, I will explain that.
Please.
He just uses all the back roads. He never, ever goes on a major road. He never goes on a major highway, because all of the traffic scenes that you see where everybody's, you know, jammed up and everything else, and they all seem to think they have this idea, right, that the fastest way is to use the freeway. And Los Angeles is just covered in freeways.
It's true.
Like, so that's the fastest way. So that's what you do. But it's not like, but if you know that it's all jammed up, you just don't get on the freeway.
Well, my thoughts on that is, and I understand where you're saying that, but of course, my thought on that is that the one issue there is that he also, like, he has to get from the suburbs of Los Angeles, where Eric Close's house is, all the way to another city, you know, where his parents were murdered. I'm just saying, like, that, it seems to me like...
To Malibu.
Yeah, he has to get Malibu, all the way to Malibu. Which is kind of hard to do just on back roads.
Well, yeah, but I am sure.
No, no.
I am sure. I that didn't bother me as much. Oh, no, like, I'm looking at it going, okay, the BAU is from Washington. And, you know, so guess what? They don't understand about traffic like this. But that's what you have to do. You just have to.
Oh, yeah. No, no.
And not be.
Oh, no. I'm not going to nitpick that.
You know what bothers me about that one?
What's that?
Why the hell didn't they take the helicopters?
Yeah, they have all these friggin' helicopters in Los Angeles. They got, like, what, 40 helicopters or some
crazy
number.
They're chasing the Prince of Darkness. They know he's going to Malibu. Why doesn't somebody get on a friggin' helicopter?
Why don't a ton of people get into helicopters? I know. Hey, you're absolutely right.
I mean, that was the thing that when I'm looking at this, well, why aren't they getting in helicopters? They know the traffic is impossible.
Yeah, this probably would have been a lot smarter. But what are you going to do? I mean, yes, they would have found the guy a lot faster. And yes, he wouldn't have been able to get away in that RV if they were chasing him in a helicopter. And this all would have been resolved much faster. But that's not what the episode's about. The episode is not about how bad they suddenly are at catching people. Okay. So, like, is it serious enough? Well, according to the episode, they phoned the Secretary of State.
Well, they eventually get the Secretary of State.
Which is crazy, by the way.
Madam, no less, buddy. So Hillary phoned them.
Yes. But we'll get there. I know,
no,
right?
I mean, okay, let's get all of this out of the way. Yeah. Plus, I'm looking at this episode and I'm going, oh, you know, I mean, we just came off the inside.
Yeah.
I have recovered. I did a blog post on my blog. So
I'm
going
to go have to read that.
It's a pretty, it's not a big one. Just telling everybody, just go read it. Set me around the bend. So go read it. Good analysis, etc. So I did that. That got it out of my system. And, but I was watching this episode and I'm going, does he essentially have the same backstory as the artist?
Right.
In The Inside, in the episode of The Inside.
Well, I mean, he also has the, I think there's some of it is similar because, let's not forget, he also has the exact same origin story as Frank. Like, literally the exact same origin story.
Yeah. You know, so you've got Frank and you, yeah, okay. So, yeah, but then maybe Frank's origin story
was also drawn from that.
No, may have been drawn then from The Inside.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Because remember, I saw The Inside after
Criminal Minds, unlike I did. Yeah.
Yeah, after I had seen that, so I wasn't. Although I did bring up Frank a couple of times in The Inside podcast.
Oh, yeah.
But Frank, yeah, it's Frank's backstory, right? And so, but so maybe they just all came from. So it's still
similar places.
And so then
yeah.
I'm just going. So did Tim and Ear just hand them the book?
No, I think they just watched the show. You know, he might have.
You never know. You know, I was sitting there going, okay, well, did he say, well, just have at it? You know, take what you want from this? Here's a few things.
It is very similar. Yeah, I mean, it is very similar with the guy from Declawed and on the inside. And unfortunately, if you're listening to this episode when we first post it, you're not going to be able to hear us talk about Declawed for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Because we're posting those as special episodes. But you can go look, check out our special episodes, and you will hear some interesting thoughts about the best show ever about serial killers. But yeah, you're not wrong to say that there's a lot of crossover there, right? Except in that case, he found a very specific MO for his killing, whereas Tim Curry just loves murder.
No, yeah. Well, and Tim Curry, too, though. I mean, he has... I mean, that's the thing. He just loves murder until you get to the last scene.
Oh, yeah. Until you get to the last scene and you and, just
and
have...
And when you get his finally get his backstory and you get that last scene.
It's beautiful. I mean, the thing is... All right, so let's just... the weird part is, mechanically speaking, there's it's just a chase episode. There's not a ton to go into. They're chasing him around the city. They have an actual moment from the real life, like the real life story of the, the Night Stalker, which is people saw him getting off a bus and it's like, hey, that looks like that guy from the newspapers, the Night Stalker. Right. And so they all chased him down as a gang. And in real life, they just caught him right then.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the true story of how he was caught. Something not unlike did that. You get a great moment where the little girl sends a kid off running to call the police to keep him from killing everybody. Like, there's a lot of fun things in this episode. It's amazingly paced. It's incredibly tense. Tim Curry gets a lot of dialogue in this where he didn't have any in the first one at all.
Yep.
And he's so good. Like, he's so good in this, and it's so impossibly sad, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing I liked, the thing that even there, when I'm complimenting it, it's like, it's the middle of the night, there's a serial killer running around your city, killing people during the blackout. And again, it's the middle of the night. Why are you answering the door and opening it to a crazy monster-looking man? Like, I'm not saying that guy in that suburban house deserves to die, but Jesus, don't open the door.
Yeah, like, maybe he didn't. I don't know. I mean, that's it. Like, I can see for the story, but it was just like, who would open the door? You would look through the door.
You'd see creepy, filthy weirdo holding up a smashed bike, and you'd be like,
Just leave it there and go call the cops.
I'll worry about it in the morning. It's like, how toxic of a jerk do you have to be to open the door in that situation and want to beat up the guy for destroying your kid's bike? Like, how bad of a dude, like, how much of an idiot do you have to be that you think that this is a good thing to do in this situation? So yeah, that really bothered me.
Oh yeah.
But it's in service of getting us to the great scene from Eric Close's daughter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so there's that. I really enjoyed it.
And where he, like, the whole thing where he looks at the picture and realizes there's a missing kid.
Oh, good.
And it's so good.
So satisfying, so well produced. Like, really, just great thriller scenes in this. The chase is really great. And then... we get to the centerpiece of the episode, which is, and the thing is, if you understand what's happening behind the scenes on the show, right? How shall I put this? Now, you and I, we watched Unsub and we watched The Inside, and the genius of those two shows is they're both about catching serial killers. But unlike Criminal Minds, they're not just about profilers.
No.
Both of them understand that if you want to catch serial killers, you need a team of various specialists working in their own fields to the best of their ability, and they get the job done. Whereas Criminal Minds seems to think, if you just throw more profilers at the problem,
that's all
you need to do. Just throw more and more and more profilers at the problem until the crime gets solved. I'm like, no, that's a very dumb idea for how to deal with the situation. And the weird part is, I think someone behind the scenes, like, well, who's sacrificable on this show? JJ, because what does she ever really accomplish? Like, what, how does she contribute? And to be fair, they rarely give JJ, like, a way to contribute in the episodes.
Yeah.
They do. Like, she's always there, but she's just bringing them the case and then kind of hanging out and not really helping. And so this episode, they're like, oh my god, they want us to fire JJ. We're gonna do a first episode of the season that proves why she's integral to the team.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think Bernero was on board for the firing.
I don't think he was.
No, when you look at this episode, you're going, I don't think he really was happy
way, right?
Yeah. No, like, way. I mean, that's how I felt. This is she plays such a central role to this particular, the solution of this particular case. And she doesn't even do it. She accepts the profile that Aaron gives her, but then she modifies it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because she does understand this better.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, she understands this better than even Aaron did.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, because it's an issue with, I mean, he's fixated on this parental issue.
Yeah.
Right? And that hits home for her.
Yeah.
You know, and you totally get why she would hear that and be able to figure out, well, what is this guy real? When you hear about his childhood, you're like, okay, here's the story to tell. Like, here's the part that's most horrific in this. And it's what his mother did to him.
Oh, yeah. Right? And she has the whole story. Mm-hmm. Because when they tell us, they don't tell us the whole story. She has the whole story and she brings up the whole thing. So not only did his mother abuse him, but he is sexually abused by some of her male clients.
Yep.
The whole thing as a child. It's no wonder, you know.
Yeah, it's no wonder he ended up this way.
He ended up. And as usual, of course, didn't get any therapy for it. But well,
of course not. He was sent to jail at 14, kept in a prison for X amount of years, you know, like 4 years, because that's how the law worked back then. And then they let him out, and he was just free to, you know, be a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
It's
tragic. It's hard to listen to. It's very well done. It's incredibly well acted by both AJ Cook and Tim Curry.
Oh, but Tim Curry is just so...
He's magnificent.
Listening to this, you know, and the fact that he sort of... When they come to the realization that it was never about anybody but the daughter, he wants to take the daughter with him,
mm-hmm.
right? That she's so... You know, she's like...
He's become
what does
this...
somebody say? The granddaughter.
It's his granddaughter. He has a chance to, like... Because he believes that he's created this guy, in a sense, this is his granddaughter, and he can not so much do right by a child, but, you know, have the love of a child, he thinks, and the acceptance. Like, he thinks he can be a good parent.
Yeah.
He has a completely warped idea of what a parent is, and there's this weird thing where you hear their profile of him, and it's like, They try to increase the threat of the episode by saying, at some point, she's going to act afraid of him, and then he's going to kill her because he won't be able to help himself. And I'm like, she's already afraid of him.
Yeah.
Like, she's That's really dumb. Afraid of him. She's openly afraid of him. I mean, she manages to pull it together to try and trick him and do things like that, but she's obviously, clearly afraid of him. That's not what he wants. He's not going to be triggered to kill her because she's afraid of him. Because he wants something else from her.
Yeah.
Right? And he clearly does. And the show establishes that really well.
Oh,
yeah.
Thing
is, it's like, I don't ever... When you watch the episode, I don't think you feel like there's ever a threat that he's going to kill the little girl.
No,
really.
I never think he's going to kill her. He just, at the end, when he's trapped, he doesn't know what to do.
No.
He already doesn't know what to do. Before JJ gets on the radio.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and this is what's so fascinating about it, is they have this conversation about how he's, how when serial killers fall apart, you know, their crimes become more frantic and nonsensical and whatnot. But this guy's quite the opposite. He's got more advanced targeting a cop and blah, 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 blah. But the weird part is, what they don't seem to notice is that is him crumbling. Like, his entire, for 25 years, he has gone under the radar because he committed crimes in disparate places using, you know, enough of a ragged MO that nobody would put it together across states. Like, he has now committed a crime that he is definitely going to get comped for, that he can't possibly get away with. Everyone knows who he is. Everyone knows who to look for. They've got an accurate description of him. They know he's traveling with this little girl. Like, he is crumbling. Like, being forced to look at his history and this guy who became a cop because of it has, like, created this obsession of him in him that's going to destroy him. Like, it's more reckless than he's at, like, doing this. He's not a cleverer plan. It's more reckless than he's ever been. But it's weird that the team, it's not like he's decompensating. He is. He's crumbling. He's falling apart. He's just doing it in this really weird way.
Yeah. This is falling apart for him.
Yeah, this is what falling apart looks like for this character.
Yeah.
And it's weird that they don't seem to understand that.
Yeah. Particularly, and they should have at least understood this. Well, Reed doesn't have a big enough role in this part.
That's true. Reed doesn't, say much this week.
No. And, but yeah, no, he's not. You can see it, like, you know, the extra.
Just in the performance. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, Tim Curry's performance is just so good. So good. You know, and then, you know, so, and then he knows that this is the end of the road for him. So he does let the little girl go.
Yep.
And then he hauls himself, puts himself in a position where it will be suicide by cop.
Yeah. He can't bring himself to kill himself, but he knows he's got to go. He knows it's over.
Yeah.
So he
he picks Derek because he let Derek live.
Well, in a sense, it's kind of good luck for him that Derek is the one who turns up. Because, I mean, given how he beat up Derek, there's a 50-50 chance Derek would be in a hospital right now. It's only Derek's, you know, obsession with revenge and getting justice for Eric Close that he shows up. Like, I mean, he was going to let himself get killed by whoever showed up. Yeah. But it just works out very neatly for him that it's Derek who gets to do it.
That Derek is there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he knows that Derek is there, so.
And yeah, I mean, is on one level it's contrived that Derek is there? Sure, but it doesn't matter because you get this beautiful scene.
Yeah, you get it, and it's just, and the tears. Do you think I'll see my mother?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my Lord. I'm just going, this is a horrible, horrible man.
Yeah.
Who is kept, and you do not have this in the first half of this these two episodes, right? The first half, you don't get that, but
at all,
you know, no. Particularly when he walks out, right? At the end of that episode, and you're just like, and then by the end of this episode, you're sitting there as he's talking, and then the tears are running down his face, like just coming out of his eyes, not running down his face, but he's already gone someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that Derek will kill him if he tries to kill one of the people. So he just
moves the gun a half an inch, and that's all it takes.
And
for
that's all it takes
Derek to shoot him.
And it's just, but you just watch him, and But when I killed her, or am I just dreaming that?
Yeah.
And Derek, Derek, of course, shows again why he should never be allowed to profile anything.
Nope. No.
He says, oh, is that why you killed all those other people? No, that's not why he killed all those other people.
No, that's not why he killed people, Derek.
He was replaying his own life.
Yes.
And that's all he kept doing, is replaying his own life.
Yeah.
You know, putting the kids in the closet like his mother put him in the closet. Yes. And
he's reenacting it over and over again. Protecting anyone.
No,
he was just recreating it's the psychodrama character all over again.
Yeah.
He is just infinitely, endlessly repeating the same theatrical abuse that was put on him.
Yeah.
And here's why I respect this episode the most. And this is, I don't know if I mentioned this in my review, right? But, what do you call it? But I feel like, in a way, what this episode, the purpose this episode serves is to be kind of a apology is too strong a term, but a mea culpa for the whole, for the Frank two-parter. Because what Tim Curry is in this episode, what he is playing is, what if the character of Frank was a real person who went through what Frank went through? He would not be a well-spoken, dapper gentleman who's able to find enough money to live independently for years crossing the country without anyone noticing. And he's, you know, so handsome and charming and blah, blah, blah that he can get by wherever he wants. That is not what a guy who went through what Frank went through would be like in real life. Like, the reason this is the same character as Frank is I really feel like Ed Bernaire is saying, let's be honest here, if Frank were to really happen, this is what he would look like. He would be a crackhead mess who stumbles around the country committing brutal murders that would be easy to catch him for if he didn't drive away from the city the second he did the crime.
Yeah. Like, they would never have caught him.
No. I mean, honestly, if but although, as we, by the way, as we said last time,
yeah.
If we're being brutally honest, they would have caught him immediately. This guy sticks out like a sore thumb. You're right. Within the world of the show, he's only caught because he comes back to L.A. and attracts the attention of the police.
Yeah, and if he had never done that, but...
Yeah, he wouldn't have been caught.
But for heaven's sakes, he's on meth.
Yeah, but he's not... Yeah, that's the thing. He's not a guy who's a brilliant planner.
Anymore.
You know?
Yeah.
He doesn't have schemes. He doesn't have plans. He just has a compulsion that, you know, gets him... ends up getting him killed. Because had he not had this compulsion to have his life mean something, well, then he just would have gotten, like, he would have kept getting away with it until, you know, he broke into a place where somebody had a gun or a cop pulled him over. And I'm like, that's all it would have taken. But he didn't all this time.
It is so interesting. And of course, mm-hmm. It is the Eric Close character that finally does it. Well, he's getting old as well, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, and of course, he's getting even older because of all the meth he's doing.
Yes.
So, you know, geez, I'm just the whole time, right? And listening to Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, the soundtrack of the episode.
Oh, it's great.
It's just great. And it fits. Not that I like Sisters of Mercy, but that's not the point.
No, it's perfect for the scene. It doesn't matter what our tastes are. It's perfect for the same.
Yeah, no, I love Leonard Cohen. Don't get me wrong.
Leonard Cohen's amazing. It's just not a fantastic set of songs.
For me. No,
yeah,
no.
For you.
It's just Sister of Mercy that bothers me. But anyway, but that's the song that he associates with his mother, right?
Yep.
Which makes sense because he's somehow or another, like he's still, the whole problem is that he is doing this over and over and replaying, as you say, like the psychodrama guy, he's replaying this over and over and over again in an entire loop because there is no way to forgive himself
mm-hmm.
for what he did because, well, first of all, nobody tells him, like, he never got any therapy. He was already
No one tells him that it's understandable that you killed your mother.
13.
No one says, no. We get it.
We get it, why you killed your mother and why you killed that man. Right. And because clearly they knew everything that had happened to him in his life. But it's beyond me. I mean, I can tell you about some of my clients, but it was beyond me. Some of the stuff. I mean, I've said this before that I've read children's aid files and I'm going, how the hell did you ever send this kid back to his home?
Yeah.
How could you? Anyway, never mind. I'm not going to go there. But this is it, right? With the Tim Curry character, right? It's like this Prince of Darkness as a child, and then there was nothing, and so he's in this endless loop. It's coming to an end. The girl, the funny thing is that, the girl is smart enough to just, but she questions him, and he never fights with her because basically he doesn't kill children.
Nope.
Right? He doesn't kill children.
Yeah.
And besides, somehow or another, he wants her as his partner.
He wants approval.
Yes, he wants her.
I think he does want her approval.
And to like him.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not going to happen.
Well, of course.
And it's only the reality. JJ manages to get through to him that this is the reality. And so he lets her go.
Well, no, and that's the thing. It's like JJ gives him the therapy that he needed all of those years ago.
Yeah.
You know, she really does. She says, I'm not a hostage negotiator, but you don't need to negotiate this guy. You just need to understand him for a second. And that's what he's never had for a moment in his life.
No. What happened to you was wrong.
Yeah.
But what happened to you
was
wrong.
And it was the worst kind. And this is what JJ says, and it's great. It's the worst possible betrayal.
Yeah.
Because it's your own parent doing it to you. Yeah, it's like it is your own parent treated you this way, brutalized you this way, allowed you to be used this way. That's why it's the worst possible betrayal.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And, you know, so, I mean, it was well written and JJ got that moment. I'm so glad she did.
Oh, and then we get to the end of the episode and we find out something that's going to come up in the next two episodes, because I'm famously so pissed about it. We find out that Eraclos's sister has died.
Yes.
And we were going to be talking about that next, but that is the last thing that happens in this episode. Everything's miserable. You know, Tim Curry has essentially killed himself. Eraclos's sister has died, but the daughter was saved. And that is where the episode ends. Let's move on to episode 602, the first Criminal Minds episode without a murder. I know that's not true. The kidnapping episode from the first season also did not have a murder. They did save that little girl, but you know,
second episode without a murder.
There you go. Maybe their second episode ever without a murder.
Yes, and it's called JJ.
Yeah,
when a Maryland teenage girl goes missing and the prime suspects pass a polygraph test despite being the last people to see her alive, the BAU juggles extracting a confession and dealing with missing girls' overprotective parents. Meanwhile, JJ contemplates a major job promotion that threatens to take her away from the team.
Yeah.
I'll sort of give the synopsis that, but she doesn't come. She's already turned it down.
She's already turned it down, but she is, I can say it's safe to say she is, I mean, within the plot of the episode, she is forced to contemplate the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Because.
But because of, you know, well, because she got fired, which is something we'll be talking about over the whole season. But okay. So first off, here's the thing. I just want to say it first. I mean, it's always important to mention this whenever, lie detector tests are used as a device in fiction. Lie detector tests aren't real. They're complete garbage. They don't work. There is no rigorous science behind lie detector tests. Basically, all it can detect is if you are suffering emotional distress. Or, really, physical distress. It can also detect, like, if your body's stress levels are raised, right?
You can have a reaction. That.
Like, it can detect a physical reaction to a situation. But the thing is, there's a million different reasons you can have a physical reaction to a situation, and the lie detector is based on the idea that it can detect that you're lying. And that's crap. It's just, that's not true. That's not how it works. Everyone doesn't react physically the same way when they lie. Like, so, full stop. These things are gibberish. Do not trust them. If someone tells you to trust a lie detector test, don't trust them. If you are ever accused of a crime and asked to take a lie detector test, call a lawyer and refuse to take a lie detector test. I can't stress that enough. Even if you didn't do it, to take the lie detector test. Honestly, especially if you didn't do it, refuse to take the lie detector test. It's going to make them more suspicious of you, but you know what? Being falsely accused of a crime is incredibly stressful. So the idea that you're going to pass the test because you're innocent, it has nothing to do with whether you're telling the truth or not. It only detects whether you're stressed or not. That's what you have to remember. So guess what? being asked to take a lie detector test when you're accused of a brutal crime or whatever is incredibly stressful. So my tip to you is, if you are ever falsely accused of a crime, 100% refuse to take that test, okay? That is my little tip to you. Okay. It's going to help. You'll look suspicious. It helps in the long run. It's just, this episode is so offensive to me because I swear to God, it treats lie detectors like they're a magic genie.
Yeah. Like, I didn't understand. Well, because they all know this, and I'm sure if we can go back.
Yeah.
This has been discussed earlier in the first 5 seasons. So, somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
That lie detector tests are not reliable. Yeah, they had that long discussion, remember, with the guy who lost his memory.
Yep.
Right? And then the idea was whether or not they were going to bring his memory back.
Ugh.
He could pass a lie detector test because...
Well, yeah, he didn't have his memory, so there you go.
There you go.
So yeah, it's... It bothers me. It bothers me a lot. Uh-huh. And I think I'm right to be bothered. I think it's understandable that I'm bothered.
Well, yeah, they built the whole episode around this, though. So
the whole episode is built around the idea that this guy could, like, oh, well, because we had the wrong specific wording on the thing, right? What do you call it? The wrong specific wording on the lie detector test, right? Then he was able to get around it because he could say something that was specifically worded to not technically be a lie. Yeah, but you also asked him when he last saw her, and he lied about that.
Yeah.
Like, even if lie detectors work in the magical way you seem to think they do on the show, you also asked him the question, when did you last see her? And he lied to you about when he last saw her. And if you didn't ask when he last saw her, you're terrible at your job.
Yeah, why didn't you?
Why didn't you ask when the last time you saw her was? Because, come on, guys. It's a freaking super relevant question.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really troubling how insultingly bad their depiction of lie detectors is in this episode. But beyond that, beyond the insultingly bad depiction of lie detectors, you know, it's a cracker episode. You know, they go in, they try to turn the guys against each other, they use all of the regular tricks in the book to get to them. Like, one of them is the follower and one of them is the leader and blah, 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 blah. Like, all of the stuff you would normally expect to see from this kind of episode, it's all right there, you know? And that's fine. I'm not complaining about them choosing to do a cracker-style episode. We've loved cracker-style episodes in the past. It's kind of strange because they already know that the guy had access to a boat and access to the marina. It's like, where's the body? Well, he's got a boat. So, the ocean? And essentially, like, the case is solved by them saying, it's like, I bet you dumped her body in the ocean in that boat of yours. And he's like, she was alive the last time I saw her. Wink.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, God, he winked. That must mean he dumped her still alive in the ocean because he knew that, you know, because he somehow knew that, lie detector tests are magic and would only respond to the specific wording of the question we asked. Like, really? Like, nothing about this guy's plan or the episode makes sense. Like, really? You were planning, you drugged a woman, you dropped her in the ocean, and you thought she didn't immediately drown? Like, I would have, had I been in this situation, I would have thought she had immediately drowned. Because I gotta say, there is no world in which, even within someone's internal, like, head logic, that drugging someone, taking them out into the ocean, while still drugged, and dropping them where you know sharks are swimming, means you didn't murder them.
Yeah.
Like, of course you murdered them. I was able to pass a... Remember when I killed... Where that guy... When I walked into the zoo and I pushed a man into the polar bear pit at feeding time? Well, I was able to tell the cops I didn't kill that guy because in my... And pass the polygraph test because in my head I know the polar bears killed him. Like, no, that's just not how humans work.
Well, you know. Unless you're a serious, serious, serious psychopath.
But even if you're a serious psychopath, it's not going to work on you anyway.
Yeah, I was just going to say that was a dumb thing to say for my yes. part.
No, and I think that's what bothered me most about the episode is, like, the whole episode is built not just about a misapprehension, but about just an out-and-out lie about how polygraphs work. Like, the entire episode is built on this ridiculous lie that is just not what polygraphs are or how they work. It's like, you can't build an entire episode around this lie and expect us to take it seriously. Also, I mean, I know this isn't a big deal, but they don't have a dead girl. And I feel like the team wouldn't be called in unless her parents are super connected. So they should have at least mentioned that the parents were super connected.
Yeah, well, this is not the first episode in recent memory where we don't know why the hell they were there.
That's true.
That's happened a lot at the in season 5.
In 6, yeah, where it's like, I don't know why they're on this case. No,
5. Even in 5, we had...
Yeah, 5 and 6, that's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah. It's, well, okay, how did they end up here?
Yeah, like, why are they involved in this case? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a pretty big problem for the show. All of the times you're like, I don't really understand why you're even here.
Yeah,
and that's not a good look for the characters.
Why isn't the regular, maybe the regular FBI is there.
Yeah.
Or maybe they would call the regular FBI in. Because, okay, oh no, what they say is they called them in because there was only like 12 hours left or 10 hours and they were going to have to let these guys go. And then they figured that this team.
Yeah, they'll give them one chance to do the psychological cracking that will hopefully break them out.
Cracker, we're going to cracker it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I get the logic between why they would call. Oh. I just don't understand why these people are important enough to be it worth flying the entire team down.
Ah, yes, but...
That's what I'm saying. Like, I know why they were called.
It's Maryland.
No, but that's my point. They specifically say they're from Maryland, so at least put in a line explaining that these people are super rich or super connected. Like, put in a line mentioning that to at least acknowledge that, no, not everybody gets this treatment.
Yeah. Honestly,
it's possible that that was a line in the script and they were told to take it down because it made the team look bad. that is possible. And then the episode...
might have sent them out because it was a politically...
Yeah, it was a politically important...
after all, the blonde-haired guy is rich and connected, so...
There you go.
Right?
And that's true. And so what's interesting here is, so this is JJ's last episode for a while... she, as we all know, she does come back. God, sorry if that was a spoiler and you're just watching it for the first time along with us. We've talked a lot about the future of this show. I talked about an episode from season 10, because, like 40 minutes ago. It's fine.
Yes. And this also means that Josh Stewart loses his continuing role.
Oh, you can't do this show without Josh Stewart, damn it.
Oh God, I saw him on a CSI.
Oh really?
Yeah.
I'll have to watch that. He's a working actor. He gets plenty of jobs. Yep. But anyway, so what's funny, though, is when you're watching the episode, right, you think the previous episode, it's kind of sad because after, you know, X amount of years of us not really understanding why JJ was there, they give her a key role to play in taking down, taking down Tim Curry.
Yeah.
But of course... It's even then it's still kind of contrived because, you know, she's only any other character would have been able to do that as well or better. She's only the one to do it because she's the one who happens to be at the radio station at the time. And it's like, I'm pretty sure I said when I was reviewing it, you know, you can just put Greg on the speakerphone, you know, like it's fine.
I'm just being silly.
No, of course you have to give her something to do, but the reason they had to give her something to do was because they had never given her anything to do, and they were trying in that episode to justify why you need her on the team, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was the writer, it was Ed Bernero saying, we want to keep this actress, here's why you need to keep her on the show, look what she can do. And I think it's telling of the way the show has no idea how these, like, the way the show has no idea how these kind of cases are actually solved, how this stuff actually works, that when JJ comes back, suddenly she's a profiler.
Yes, well, remember, and never mind, we're not going to talk about
that. No, but we'll talk about that when she comes back, but it's just like, it goes back to their failure to create an unsub-style team with diverse skills. The one thing about JJ was, she had a role.
Yeah.
She was the one who sifted through all the things, tried to figure out which case was the most pressing, and presented it to them.
Yeah.
Right? She had a job. And when she comes back, she doesn't have a job anymore, she's just one of the 18 profilers they bring on every case. And it's like, so instead of finding a way in these two episodes to show why she was important, they just say a sad farewell, and then, you know, no more JJ for X amount of time, and they bring in yet another profiler. And it's sad. But what's sadder is the way the episode ends with a long monologue.
Oh.
Which is AJ Cook talking to the fans.
Yeah. That's all it was.
But, and that's the part. It's like they make basically zero attempt to justify that monologue within the episode. Like, essentially no attempt is made to justify the existence of that monologue within the episode. It's just this heart-wrenching, yeah, I know you're happy that I'm not going to be on the show anymore.
You're
I'm
unhappy
too.
Yeah, you're unhappy, you said happy.
Yeah. So yes, you're not happy that I'm not going to be in the show anymore. I'm unhappy too. It's out of our hands. And that is the whole meta-narrative of the episode. She's being taken away, right? Yeah. And it's completely out of their hands. Like, they are losing her, right? She is being stolen from the team for no reason, right? And it's fascinating that they were able to get that thing on the show. Now, I'm sure there were screaming arguments about whether or not they were going to be allowed to put in a whole monologue criticizing CBS on television. But more power to them. They got it done. You know, they got that message out there. And I really respect them for sticking to their guns and getting the message out into the episode. Like, way to go, guys. It was so nice. It's a farewell. I mean, the only other thing that has come close to this in a TV show is the episode of Wise Guy where Ken Wall quit the show.
Yeah.
Two episodes into a story arc, Ken Wall quit the show. And then all the characters had to be like, well, what are we supposed to do now? And so they actually have a scene where, you know, Frank and Roger just sit around talking about Ken Wall. And they couch it, in they're talking about the character, but it's clear to the viewer what is happening.
Yeah.
They are talking about Ken Wall and how you don't just leave people, you know, you don't just leave people on a show.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing, and I loved it. And it works better there because they actually managed to make it part of the character's internal lives and part of the episode.
Yeah.
In a way they don't make it at all in this episode.
No, well,
like in this episode, it's literally just, you know, AJ Cook talking to the fans. And great, that's great. But it's like, it is an almost unique thing on television that they gave her this opportunity to do it, and I'm glad they did.
Yeah.
It's so strong, and it's so sad to listen to, because you're like, Jesus, they did wrong by her, and there's no other way to describe it.
So, you know? CBS does wrong by a lot of people.
Yeah, no, okay.
You're right. It's not the first time.
There's no mystery to it. You're absolutely right. This isn't the first. It's not going to be the last, but it's like,
I mean, for God's sake, by the end of the season, they fired Padgett Brewster, too.
Brewster, too, yeah. Okay, you're right. I almost shouldn't make such a big deal out of it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's so frustrating.
No, it was very, like, it is very, very frustrating. And it's very frustrating at the beginning of season 7 when they bring her back. But we'll get there.
We'll get there when we get there. Yeah.
That frustration for there. What I will say, I mean, and Wise Guy, to some extent, I think Wise Guy handled it an awful, awful lot better. They certainly didn't handle, because you know, Ken Wall pulled a Mandy Patinkin, or Mandy Patinkin pulled a Ken Wall.
Ken Wall is more accurate.
Yeah. And Ken Wall, I mean, of course, he regrets it. He's regretted it ever since. But well, they managed to make that that part work.
Yeah, like, they
If I'm to think, if I was to think about, they managed to handle that and make it work, like the writers for Wise Guy.
Yeah, of course.
You know, because that's the same episode where you did post up the clip, or you're going.
Yeah, he leaves, and the weird part is I posted the clip of the profiling. Literally,
it's from that.
Ken Wall walks out of that scene, and he doesn't come back to Wise Guy for 7 episodes or 6 episodes. He does come back to finish out the season, right? And there's actually a whole lot of conversation about whether or not it was a good idea for him that we're going to talk about when we end up discussing Wise Guy, because it's become clear that's inevitably going to happen at some point.
Oh, yeah, but then we're going to have to see if we can find a place for people to watch the Tim Curry ones.
Yes. If only someone is going to create a YouTube channel called Wise Guy Fan 83. Yeah. And just post all of them. I wonder if that will happen between now and then.
I'm hoping.
Stop making me say this out loud and just trust me. But anyway. But yeah, it's a unique, it's an almost completely unique episode of television. And while this is a pretty terrible episode of Criminal Minds.
Yeah, it is.
I really do like the end of the episode and that they gave them a chance to say goodbye to this character who's been part of the team since day one.
Yeah. You know, and she calls it a family and all of those things.
Now, the whole thing about how it's out of my hands and no one's happy about this. And
yeah.
It's so tough.
Oh, it was just so it was so great. It's an executive order. I mean, at least they made it, you know, it was
within the narrative of the show.
Yeah.
It came from
the top. It was even out of Aaron Strauss's hands.
Yep.
You know, as Hodge said, you know, it's not even Aaron can't do anything about it. Aaron might have let it go. But
yeah.
So we can blame Les Moonves for this, too.
Let's hope we can.
Well, I'm just saying.
Given everything we know about Les Moonves, you're right. I don't know why I'm questioning
that. Why are you questioning that? Ed Bernero couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, it's true. Was,
you know, and neither could Mark Goodman. So,
yeah.
You know, because I don't think Mark Goodman would have cared.
Yeah. Okay. You're right. I should not question that at all. All right. So let's move on to the third episode of the season. The first episode to not have JJ in it since the show was started.
Yep. So it's called Remembrance of Things Past. When two Bristol, Virginia women are tortured, sodomized, and fatally electrocuted, the BAU sets out to determine whether or not the crimes were committed by a prolific serial killer who murdered 20 women over the course of 9 years and was never caught.
Ooh. Yep, that's right. It's an old case of Davids.
Yep.
Right? And he, what do you call it? It's interesting how much he botched this case back in the day, as we find out.
Mm-hmm.
But he is there working on a book, and we're actually going to later this season, maybe in season 6, we're going to see the book he's working on. And it's interesting because I've previously criticized David Rossi's hypocrisy in a little episode called Limelight, where he...
which just went up this week.
I know. What an amazing coincidence. No, it's a perfect episode to be talking about because of that. I've talked about his hypocrisy in the episode Limelight because he's, you know, he so obviously loves the celebrity he gets.
Mm-hmm.
He loves being a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And he is so judgmental. Like every now and then he will make some passing comment about it being, you know, a bad thing. And it's like, oh, we don't like the celebrity. But by and large, this character obviously likes being a rich, famous person. He doesn't wear nice clothes. He still, actually he does. I was just going to say, he doesn't wear nice clothes. But no, he just didn't wear nice clothes in the first episode he appeared in.
Because they were making a joke. They are understated elegance. Because he can't look like Okay, yeah. He's dressing better than everybody else.
Exactly, but he's still wearing very expensive leather jackets. He's wearing super nice expensive clothes, but he doesn't want to dress better than everybody else, because as you say, at least he's sensitive to that. But what I find interesting is, in the first... but he clearly loves being a celebrity, loves doing it, and as they point out, we're just three seasons at this point away from limelight, and he's already working on a book about his new cases after his triumphant return to the BAU.
Where he solved the case that haunted him. Now, exactly. Obviously, this was another case that should have haunted him.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to have.
But he didn't write about this case because it was solved.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, it's weird. No, yeah. And it's weird because when Jeff Pearson was in season 2, right? He had written a book about the show's BTK. And it's weird, in a sense, maybe he should have written a book about this serial killer, because maybe it would have helped him catch him, the way Jeff Pearson writing that book about BTK helped them catch BTK. And it's weird because the crazy part is, like, it was too close to him and he hadn't solved it and he couldn't write about it. When we see him, what do you call it? I feel like when we see him writing the book, I could be misremembering this. We actually see, like, the first page of the chapter he's working on, and I swear to God, the page he's working on is the electrocutioner, is what he calls him.
Yeah.
And it's this case.
Probably, right?
I feel like I'm remembering this right.
Well, let's just wait till we get there, because
we get there. But it would just be an interesting thing, given, you know, this guy's feelings. And I think it's telling, and maybe this is all coincidence, maybe I'm seeing patterns that are there, but isn't it fascinating that the next guy, the time he got so mad about someone wanting to be famous and write books and blah, 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 it was a guy who raped women, tortured them with electricity, right? And now, the next time we see him working on a book, it's about a guy who rapes women and tortures them to death with electricity. That's weird, right?
Let's wait till we get there.
I know, but I just think it's... No, yeah. I'm saying just if
it
you
is
look
weird.
At limelight and then this, the two, he made a complaint about fame and blah, 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 and how it's a bad thing to chase, blah, 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 blah. It's a case that. And this time, we see him writing on new book while they're dealing with essentially the exact same MO killer.
Yeah, but I just
find that fascinating.
Well, no,
it could be a complete coincidence.
What happens, of course, is he's blocked, right?
Yeah.
He's got writer's block, and this case resolves his writer's block.
That's true.
And
I mean,
it's bookended with him trying to write
Later we do see the book. Like I said, later, years later, maybe months, maybe years later, we will see the book he was writing. And he's talking about either this case or possibly the limelight case. But I think this case is what he's working on. I could be wrong about that, but we'll find out soon enough.
Oh, no, he can. He can write about it now because it's been resolved. And he can probably kind of slosh over, you know, kind of...
Oh, no, I'm sure he can gloss over. It just would be fascinating. I mean, again, we're talking about meta David Rossi here. I don't expect the writers to ever address anything, but wouldn't it be great if the reason he was so against her becoming famous and writing books is that his feelings of inadequacy over not being able to solve this case that was incredibly similar to the case she was working on? Just that would be a fascinating way to look at meta David Rossi, wouldn't it?
But we're looking at meta Reed, so why not?
Why not? I mean, all right. So you know what? When we see the text of his book, we're going to have a look at that. We are going to have a look at which case he was talking about, because either one, I think it's fascinating to draw a connection between this and limelight. Like whichever specific cases was being written about in the book, I think the connection to limelight is obvious, and I'm going to say inescapable. So there you go.
And
so let's talk about the actual case. But what do you have to say first?
No, no. All I was going to say is, yes, this actual case is not like the episode is not, because we just spent all this time talking about David Ross.
I know.
It's like it's an interesting case, because you're going, okay, so what if a serial killer gets Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
That's basically what it is. He's and then we hear the backstory of the poor little kid, his son,
mm-hmm.
who has never been allowed to grow up.
Or really become a complete person.
Yeah, become a complete
person. He has been his father's, you know, assistant his whole life.
Yeah.
Like, literally, he was there and he witnessed the murder of his mother as a child, and he witnessed a bunch of other murders. And his father, right, and then, of course, and he even became apprentice to his father at the electrician's business and never stopped living with his father. Like, he has never had a separate personality.
Yeah.
Apart from his relationship with his father.
Yeah. So, and it's, well, yeah, that's because Lord only knows he learned very early. It only took once for him to learn never backtalk your dad.
Oh,
particularly,
yeah.
Because, and the funny thing is he doesn't really have that first one. Like, when he talks about that first one where they dragged, so he has that memory, but he does not remember it's his mother, because the mother mm-hmm. was the first crime. So that's interesting that they go back and they look at the first, like they get there. Let's look at the first one. Okay. And then Rossi says, well, I interviewed this guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is not at the end, right? Where you see, so it's Daniel Travanti who plays the serial killer.
Yeah. Daniel J. Travanti from Hill Street Blues and a lot of 80s television. Yeah. Really good actor.
Yeah. He shows up every now and then.
Really good performance in this episode, too.
And really good performance as this horrible, horrible, horrible serial killer who's got Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And who keeps then redoing the same case over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
He forgets. No, no, we can only do one a week or one every so often. No, no, we did one yesterday. No, we didn't.
Yeah.
We have to go out again. Right. And it's like, I mean, they do a really nice job of this.
It's a really well observed. I think you would agree that it's a very well observed treatment of Alzheimer's.
Of this guy, how like, of the idea of a serial killer getting Alzheimer's.
Oh, no, no. But I'm saying the actual the way the guy responds to forgetting things.
Oh,
like, it's not just that he forgets things, it's the refusal to admit you're forgetting things.
Yeah. And then he has that somehow or another, because he's still back in the past, he has that memory. And the reason he stopped, but of course we never get an answer as to why he stopped, except he tells Rossi that it's because it was after he met with David Rossi.
Yeah.
That he
And quit. Actually, that's one of the things that bothers me about the episode is... Yeah. It is not unusual, like, they should know about how serial killers operate, but it's actually not unusual for them to get scared into stopping, or at least taking a long break, after getting police attention.
Yeah.
So, when the guy suddenly stopped, and now there are a couple of reasons, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, that he's dead, he's in prison, blah, 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 blah. But if the crimes have started up again, and it's obviously not a copycat, but rather the same guy, because he has information only the real guy had, well, then what your first guess should be, okay, well, he stopped because the police got too close.
Yeah.
Right? And now the heat is off, he assumes, so he's gone back to killing. Right. And so literally the first thing David should have done, and again, the character David should have known to do this because they've talked about it before, is if he stopped if he stopped like that, he probably stopped because he knew you were getting too close, meaning you, David Rossi, have definitely talked to this killer. Go back through everyone you interviewed everyone you interviewed when you're working the case. One of them is the killer.
Yeah, that would have made sense.
Yeah, that would have made sense. And he could have, and had they done that, the team would have looked so much smarter had they done that. Because then you could say, there's 1,500 people on this list. Right?
Yeah.
Right? And then, but then he would have been, while the rest of them, like, how interesting would it have been to, in an episode about Alzheimer's, right, to have David Rossi trying to go through his notes and trying to remember something about all of the people he talked to.
Yeah.
Right? And then going list it and going deeper and deeper and deeper into it, and then remembering something of note about this guy and his son. And then they're like, wait a minute, why wasn't this woman forced to call somebody? And then coming to the conclusion that, of course, there's no one for her to call. It's her husband that's killing her.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a good conclusion. But it's like, they get way too late into the idea that, that he's talked to them. Like, the fact that he's talked to them should have been a given based on the fact that he stopped.
Or, yeah, it should have been a possibility.
Yeah, or at least a possibility. Yeah, it should have been a possibility.
Not necessarily a given, but it should have been a definite possibility and all of that. After all, Mandy did it when they were looking for the pedophile.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly what he did. Okay, we must have talked to this guy. So mm-hmm. Who did we talk to back then?
Yeah.
You know?
And it would have made them look smarter. And the thing is, if you talk to 100 or, 200 people during a case, that's not a gimme.
No.
Right? It's not like you're immediately getting handed the solution, yeah. But it would have been an interesting thing to acknowledge that they know how these people's minds work, because that's their whole frigging job, the name of the show. But anyway, right, they know how these people think, so they could have used that as a way to narrow down the possibilities. And I would have found that to be, I would have found that to be very impressive, and it would have been nice. Because otherwise, you're just going through the list, and we're like, okay, well, why would they have not, the only clue they have really is why did this one lady not call her family?
Yeah.
Right? And that is a good clue, but I really wish they had acknowledged the other big clue they have, which is they stopped after David Rossi came to town. Like, the murders stopped once David Rossi was in town. Oh, well, why is that? Oh, there's a good reason for it. You probably talked to him.
Yeah, you probably.
And they all know how this works enough that they could have come to that conclusion.
Now here's where, because the quote, of course, is from Proust.
Of course.
From Remembrance of Things Past.
Yeah.
Where he says, the way you remember it is not the way it was. Now.
Yes.
So I am assuming, I guess, that refers to the kid.
Yes, that his memories of his mother. Yeah.
Okay. It would have been better if it had referred to, like, it's a confusing title, and it was a confusing thing.
Yeah.
Because after we finished talking about how David Rossi should have figured, maybe we talked to him. At least he should have.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and he doesn't remember it correctly, clearly, either. In fact, he's got writer's block. Maybe this was the episode this was the man he was trying to write about, because they ask him, well, why didn't you write about this case? Well, because we never solved it. Well, yeah, is that a good enough reason not to write about a case? and it obviously...
Actually, that makes me wonder, did he ever write about the Killer Santa case?
Well,
he didn't solve that one either.
Well, we don't know.
No, yeah, they're not going to tell us what's in David Rossi's books.
Too
bad.
We can just...
No, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, it definitely is an interesting thing about his character.
Uh-huh. Right?
And it really, I know we've been very hard on David Rossi recently, but it's only because I genuinely think he's not a good person. Like, I generally think this character isn't a good person. Like, he's arrogant. He's kind of a jerk to people all the time. Like, and I mean, it's only been reinforced because I just watched and reviewed the episode where he meets his daughter. And I'm like, you're kind of a trash person, David.
Yeah, no, he's
always.
And I
suspect you always have been.
Yeah. And to some extent, he's aware of that.
Yeah.
Right. To some extent, he's aware that he's not a nice person. I mean, with his three marriages and his clearly more relationships that he walks out on and stuff like that. He's David Rossi is just the Italian version of Shamar Moore,
In a sense, yeah.
He's well, not, especially when, but he's nicer to people.
Oh, he's nicer to people. But at the same time, I go back to that moment, right? In midway through season five, right?
Uh-huh.
Where A body has been thrown into a ditch. And
yeah, and he makes... Oh.
And he makes Reed, who was shot
yeah.
in the leg. And by the way, Matt Gubler, who freaking broke his tendon the summer before, walk down the hill so that he won't have to scuff up his nice new boots.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're a bad person, David Rossi.
Now, hopefully the writers understand that they are writing a bad person.
I hope. I really do. Because if they think he's just being, you know, oh, he's just being puckish. Like, no, he's not. He's a oh. bad guy.
Because they never really address that kind of thing.
No, they
don't.
You know,
that he's not really, you know, this, and a nice person. Heaven only knows, right?
Yeah.
You know, wait till we get to the episode of, you know, the, where he has to, where his wife wants.
Oh, God, no, don't her. Even, I can't no. think about that until we get there. I just, yeah. I can't.
It's just, we'll be, oh. I'll be screaming along with you, so it's okay.
Yeah.
But this remembrance of things past. Yeah, it was an okay episode. It was a good episode from beginning.
Yeah.
Like it was a, it's you know, okay it worked episode. Okay. Then we've got some quibbles and stuff with it.
Honestly, I really do believe they would have trouble just the mechanics of it.
Yes.
Their entire plan is to grab people on the street in broad daylight. Like that is their plan to kidnap women, and it just keeps working over and over and over again. And no one sees these women, you know, get snatched and grabbed and pulled into vans. I'm like, it seems like a stretch. Slightly,
yeah, and,
but...
and how many women would go with
Yeah,
this
would go with
guy,
this creepy-looking, disheveled
looks,
old man.
Right? That's like, who would go with Tim Curry the way
yeah.
he looks, right? Who would yeah. go with Prince of Darkness? Who would go, which is why the Prince of Darkness...
Darkness could never get away with that kind of murder.
Right? Who would open
no
the
one
door
would, yeah.
to the Prince of Darkness, frankly? But
we literally just talked about that an hour
yeah.
ago.
And
there's no way that guy should have opened that door, because look at this man.
Yeah, I can see why people would help the woman, you know, with the dolls.
Of course.
You know, but
yeah.
this man?
No.
He,
no, no way.
Know, and my, you know, my, whatever he called him, his helper, you know,
yeah.
Has had a heart attack. Well, okay, call 911.
Call 911. You all have cell phones. Why? It's and like, what is she going to do
yeah.
to help a guy who's had a heart attack? All he can do is call 911. All she can do is call 911. So why doesn't she just call 911?
This is 2010.
Yeah, so she's definitely got a cell phone.
Yeah.
Like, in the first season, the first two, three seasons of the show, what do you call it? You can kind of say, okay, maybe some of these characters don't have cell phones. This episode was made in 2010. Even I had a cell phone by 2005, and I hate cell phones.
Yeah.
I, like, physically can't use many cell phones. I had a cell phone in 2005. Everyone within the world of this show... By 2010, probably, like, it's a little weird that any of the characters on the show even have a home phone at this point.
Yeah.
That's how ubiquitous cell phones are. So, yeah, the idea that he could say, my caretaker is having a heart attack, please help, and she wouldn't just take out her phone and call 911 is ludicrous.
Yeah. So, like, you know, yeah, that it, yeah. there's a lot of things wrong with this episode. But, yeah, I mean, it is, but it does... The rationale, the...
Yeah, the psychology of the episode is good.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, he goes, because as he starts to, you know, as the Alzheimer's starts to hit, and he's got a nasty relationship with his
oh,
son
yeah.
just wants to keep him happy. And has
mm-hmm.
he's been used to doing this, and then didn't do it for a while, so he had a respite, but when his father starts up again, well, okay, yeah, that's what I gotta do.
He feels like he doesn't have any choice.
Yeah.
Because again, he's not a separate person from his father.
No.
He's never developed his own persona.
No.
I mean, it's tragic, but at
yeah.
the same time, you know, you always want to say, and that's the thing is, that's so, what's so hard to get into the abused spouse Stockholm situation. It's like, you just want to say, why didn't you call the cops? You could have called the cops at any time. And the answer is because they honestly don't understand that that's an option.
Yeah.
Like, they don't. It would never occur to them to call the police on these people because they don't believe it's an option. It doesn't exist in their head as a possibility.
Well, you know? I mean, after all, his father killed his mother and made him watch it. And the mother said, it's not your fault. And,
yep.
You know, the whole thing.
Lots of tragic tragic upbringings this week.
Yeah.
Well, it's two, but they're really bad ones.
Yeah, this is. But the thing is that Tim Curry pulls it off.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Tim, at the end of that, when you're watching him, you know, he's going to die and he knows he's going to die. He's chosen to die, but you just look at it and you just go, this is another one of those ones where you just go, he didn't have a chance.
No, he never had a chance.
Friggin' had a chance. Like had in the earlier episodes. So every now and then, like when maybe I'll do this at some point, just pull out all the Edward Bernero written episodes,
yeah, and see what the themes are there.
Because, like, I mean, that's still what I would say at the beginning, you know, that there was, it was much clearer when we're now starting season six, where things start to go just off the rails.
Yeah.
And you go back to sort of the first two seasons and you just go, okay. You know, like there was still,
he was trying to say something. And I think it's important here. He was trying to say something and he had his own stuff to work through.
Yeah. You know, and as we all do, all you have to do is listen to our bonus podcasts on the inside.
Oh yeah.
All
absolutely.
Stuff, right.
Completely.
But I think he was trying to tell stories, you know, and that I think that, like, it's really hard to know just what the situation was that, you know, because we're going to be getting angrier and angrier because what happens, we have these businesses of the girl, like Ellie is her name, Spicer's daughter. Amy?
Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about, we get that one check-in with her this week where she's told, where Derek has continued checking in on her and has found out that she's, you know, quote unquote, doing okay in school and blah, 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 blah.
Well, she calls him every morning and she calls him every night.
Yeah.
And then Emily makes that nasty comment, right?
I know,
and
but he's getting too involved.
And I'm just like looking, wait, what's this? He's promised her. And so we still have the possibility that, you know, this shift will happen and then it's just don't. So.
No. And the thing is, and that's why that scene is so heartbreaking. Cause it's like Emily, who was frigging ready to adopt a kid last year.
Yeah.
She was ready to adopt a kid and take the kid back with her.
Yeah.
Last year. And now she's the one and she only didn't because they found
relative.
They found the relatives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And she's the one friggin' telling Derek that he's getting too close to this.
Yeah.
It's obscene. It's obscene, especially because Derek knows what she's going through.
Yeah.
Derek had this exact same experience. He's literally, like, other than his job, he is, you know, taking him away so much. He's, like, the best possible foster parent for this girl.
Yeah. And he promised the father he would take care of her.
And he promised the father he would do it.
Trust me.
And so when they dump out of this storyline in, what, 2 weeks? 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Is it even that long? I mean, I'm going to find out. I'm going to watch all three episodes tonight, so I guess I'll find out. Yeah. But it's like, when they dump out of this episode, this storyline, I don't know that I've ever been, like, okay, we often talk about how disappointed we are that the revelations about Derek Morgan didn't influence his persona. That they didn't influence his persona to an extent that they act like it's progress, that it's a big step for him, that he is at age 40 moving in with his girlfriend because of the threat that she was going to break up with him. Like, that's not progress as a character. That is like the first steps, you know, towards adulthood that you should have been making 15 years ago, Derek. Yeah. Like, they act like, oh, well, you know, it's a big step for him. The man's 40 years old. This is the first serious relationship of his life.
there's something deeply upsetting about that, but the episode is just charmed that he's finally moving in with his girlfriend. He doesn't even propose. It's like, here's a key to the house that I've renovated for us to live in. That, did that key come with a wedding ring? Because you're 40. Jesus Christ.
She might want children.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's a couple years younger with you. She might want children. Have that conversation right friggin' now. But anyway, the point is, like, so we have this overall conversation, right, about stuff that bothers us about Derek Morgan's, like, refusal to accept things, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, refusal to grow up, refusal to get therapy, refusal to deal with his own crap.
Refusal to take responsibility.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. But that's this is the single most acute example of what pisses me off about the character. Because this was their moment. Six seasons in, this is their moment to have Derek Morgan start growing up. Mm-hmm. And instead of just committing to that, they throw it away and embrace all of the worst parts of Derek Morgan.
Yeah, well.
That's why I'm so mad at this episode. Because it's pointing to what's going to happen in an episode or two when they just throw it all away.
As I said,
this is the season.
This is the season where things go off the rails, and this is the season where so many people stop watching it.
And I know they're all fictional characters.
Yeah.
But let's not forget, Eric Close's sister only dies so that mechanically Derek Morgan can have this opportunity to grow as a character.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason that character dies.
And then they dump it. And it's just...
So, yeah, screw you, this show.
But as I said, you'll hear it again, but I mean, it's probably why we get so angry with the show, is that it had the possibility to do things that after I finished watching The Inside, I just went, okay, you so there the was a show, there was the a potential. Show
yeah.
that had the potential, and you could see that if it had lasted, there would have been growth in the characters, etc., right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can even accept, for example, in this show, that Reed is going to take a long, long, long time. I don't get so upset that Reed doesn't grow up. Because Reed's abuse, Reed is from within the family. And the thing and the difference, and I guess that's what makes me so mad. His abuse is from within the family. It is so couched in all of these weird forms. And, you know, so for him to even begin to grow out of all of that and to be able to become a functioning adult with relationships and things like that, I can actually buy that. That doesn't make me angry. It makes me angry with Derek. Because he had this wonderful, caring family. He has a mother. He has two sisters.
He has cousins he's close to. He's got this whole extended support system.
He's got a whole, I know that the abuse had a major impact on him. We saw Profiler profiled. Yeah. Brilliant, like what was going to happen with that character. And so you're looking at that. And what we get is this. So you had the ability to watch this character change and grow over 15 years, for God's sake.
And they threw it away. 12 years before he leaves, I know.
13 years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever it ends up being.
Yeah.
But they throw it away.
Yeah.
And this coming episode that we're going to get so mad about is the moment they throw it away. And they confirm that, no, Derek's never going to get better. And the show's never going to admit there's anything wrong with him. Not really.
No.
All right, so...
on that unhappy note...
If you're wondering why we're getting so mad about the show, just listen to our The Inside miniseries that's going to be going up every Monday until we're done with The Inside. The week, essentially what happened was we watched the end of season 5 of Criminal Minds, and then we spent 1 week recording episodes about every single, almost every, I mean, every single episode, but like two of them got like an episode just devoted to one episode of the show.
Yeah.
That's how good the show is. Yeah. Right. So there's like 7 or 8 episodes.
No, there's 7 episodes.
There's 7 episodes of the miniseries. Right. So you're going to be listening to that every Monday if you'd like to hear the context for why we're now so mad at Criminal Minds.
I knew and, what was going to happen after I finished watching
these. Yeah, well, just you're going to listen to us in a couple of those episodes. We dread how tough we're going to be on Criminal Minds when we come back to it. Like, this was predicted. You're just not going to hear the predictions until you listen to those episodes. So yeah, we're not like doing one episode about Criminal Minds, one episode about, when we were recording, it's not one and one, because you have to understand the show inside to understand what happens next week. Speaking of, would you care to give us the list, rundown of the episodes we're going to do as homework for next week?
Compromising Positions.
Okay.
Safe Haven.
All right.
And Devil's Night.
Oh, Devil's Night. Oh, I'm excited to talk Devil's Night.
I can only see it.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
So yeah, join us back here next time for episodes 604, 605, and 606. We're going to be talking a lot about Rachel Nichols.
Poor Rachel Nichols.
Poor Rachel Nichols. Like, just poor Rachel Nichols. And if you wonder why we're saying that, well, that's what the Inside podcast is for.
Yeah, just go and watch the Inside on YouTube.
Yeah, you can watch all the Inside. Although I don't, what do you call it? Yes, no, I was about to say, just don't get confused. It turns out the 13th episode is misnamed, but it is the 13th episode. Like, the playlist that we'll give you is, it says it's the wrong episode, but it's actually the right episode. Don't worry about it. All right. So I guess that's that. If you'd like to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments about the departure of JJ or the imminent arrival of Rachel Nichols, we'd love to hear about it. And if you have any questions for us, and if you'd like to suggest any profiling-related fiction we should check out, be sure to drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on a podcasting app, be sure to give it a rating. If you want to leave a review, that apparently helps us a lot because it tells it to recommend it to people. And check this out. I know you might have been listening to this on iTunes for the past 3 seasons, so this is going to sound weird, but in real life, when we were recording it, this is the week we got on iTunes. So, yay! You can now listen to it on iTunes. Although, again, you might have already been doing that for 3 seasons. It's confusing when you record stuff this far in advance. It gets confusing. Anyway, so I guess that's that. Until next time, I just want to say thanks for listening and au revoir. Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.